Welcome to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, Boyd School of Law. Welcome, counsel, and students and faculty members that are also here today. And we also have an esteemed jury. These are all law clerks or staff attorneys working for the Court of Appeals. So glad you're able to sit up front. And is it like you're in class or what? cameras are allowed in the courtroom today unless somebody objects in the next 5 seconds. All right, so we will have cameras. We haven't had an argument at Boyd School of Law since January of 2020. Of course, everybody knows the pandemic hit right after that, so we're very happy to be back. We give our thanks to the law school and those of you that could be here today, and also to counsel for willingly and happily participating in this process. It's a little different. It's a learning experience. Just try and put yourself for a moment back in your law school days. Maybe you don't want to. I'm joined today by Judge Bonnie Bulla to my left and Judge Deborah Westbrook to my right. Judge Bulla, do you have any welcoming comments?
Well, we're very happy that you all are here with us today. It's a pleasure to be at Boyd. We thank the school and all of the students for helping us through our oral argument today.
Judge Westbrook?
And I will echo what Judge Bulla and Chief Judge Gibbons said. We're so grateful to all of you for being here and grateful to Boyd for allowing us to have our oral argument in your lovely moot courtroom.
And counsel, I know you're already aware of this, but we asked if you would be available after the argument to stay and answer a few questions from the students or the professors, and just briefly explain your reaction to not only doing oral argument, but doing it in this environment. So nothing long, but we'll see if there are any questions, and we're going to go directly to that when we finish the arguments today, so you don't have to wait to the conclusion of the second case, which is a criminal case. Very interesting case, but you might not want to stay for that. So that's the process we will follow. So anyone that has questions, start putting that together in your mind. But keep in mind, of course, we can't talk about the specifics of the case because these cases today obviously have not been decided. So the questions have to be more general in nature. The first case up today is number 84007-COA, Mariel Armstrong, on behalf of the estate of Roy Armstrong, appellant versus Las Vegas Post Acute and Rehabilitation, LLC, doing business under the same name, and also another respondent. So this is an interesting case. We selected this and the case after this specifically because we thought there were interesting issues for the students, faculty, and of course for the court too. And it's an important case. And so you were lucky if you look at it that way that you were chosen to have your case presented here. So the procedure is 15 minutes of argument per side. The appellant can reserve time for rebuttal argument. The court could ask questions of either counsel at any point during the argument. We try to let people get their argument out, but there's always our questions. All right, we have A.J. Sharp on behalf of the appellant Armstrong. Mr. Sharp, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice. May I please report? I will reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Okay.
Thank you. And we have Candace Herling representing all the respondents today. Ms. Herling, welcome to you. Of course, you won't have any rebuttal. I mean, it's actually happened where we've let the respondent say something depending on what happened in the appellant's rebuttal, but that's certainly out of the ordinary, so don't expect that's going to happen. So you'll just have a straight 15 minutes. And you should be able to see the little lights, everybody, to know where you are on the time. All right, Mr. Sharp, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is A.J. Sharp. I represent the appellate in this matter, who is also present in the courtroom, Mariel Armstrong, who is suing both in her capacity as an individual and also as the special representative of the estate of her late father, Roy Armstrong. The issues that are before the court today, I think, were fairly well spelled out in the briefing, but I want to point out that the overarching theme of the situation we are today, it's very hard to identify the path that the district court took to get from the discovery offense that the defendant brought up to the sanction of the exclusion of the experts and then the resulting motion for summary judgment. The reason being only one legal authority was cited in the motion to strike the experts, and that was NRCP 16.1A3. That was the only legal authority for supporting the sanction. And that rule applies only if a party fails to comply with Rule 16.1, which is about disclosures of evidence, documents, witnesses, and experts, or if that party fails to comply with an order of the discovery commissioner under Rule 16.3. Obviously, neither of those things is at issue here. The experts at issue here were timely disclosed during discovery. The only shortfall was that they were not produced for deposition during the discovery period. So obviously, Rule 16.1E3 doesn't even apply here, because the only two things it applies to aren't even alleged to have happened in this case, let alone happened in this case. And before I go any further, let me state unequivocally, I don't at all minimize or trivialize the discovery offense that occurred here. It was very inexcusable for these experts to not be produced for deposition. I'm sure you've read the briefing and you see that there were a lot of personal issues for the attorney involved, but I think that attorney dropped the ball. I think that the local counsel, who had been engaged since the primary counsel was from Texas, certainly dropped the ball and was actually reprimanded by the district court for failing to monitor the case after sponsoring a provocative
statement. Mr. Sharp, let me just interrupt you for a minute and ask this question.
Of course.
Was there a 2.34 conference with counsel regarding making sure the depositions could be taken during the discovery period?
I don't believe there was. Nothing in the record reflects that there was. I won't say that there weren't conversations between counsel for the parties. Obviously, you know, we saw a lot of correspondence. We saw a lot of back and forth, mm-hmm. where the depositions were noticed multiple times and then vacated multiple times, and then finally they took non-appearances for the two experts. But nothing was ever done that was expressly labeled a 2.34 conference, and no motion was ever filed with the discovery commissioner.
Where were the depositions going to take place?
In Las Vegas. I'm not sure of the exact location.
So the plan was to bring the deponents the experts to Las Vegas to be deposed?
I believe so. I believe they're actually from Las Vegas. I could be wrong about that.
I think one actually may have been from Illinois and one from Pennsylvania.
But obviously we would have the burden to bring them here, or to arrange to depose them there at our expense if we chose experts from out of state. So.
Was that discussed as a remedy?
I should tell you up front, I was not involved in the case during these, so I pretty much have the same record you do as far as what happened before. I don't believe that was discussed as a remedy.
So is your position that there should have been an order under NRCP 37 to compel the depositions before enforcement of striking the experts occurred?
Well, I think that would have been the third step in the process. The first step would have been genuine meet and confer efforts, a personal conversation, telephone or in person, between counsel to try to resolve the problems, and then a motion to compel under Rule 37. The third step would be actually an order. And of course, if that order were issued and were not complied with by the plaintiffs, then we would be under Rule 37B1, which somehow we ended up there anyway, even though this case didn't follow that path. So, as I was saying, it's hard to identify the exact authority that the court relied on, because the motion to strike the experts, which was really the dispositive action here, the motion for summary judgment was a given once the experts were stricken, because you can't prove medical causation at trial without experts. So the defendant only cited to Rule 16.1E3, and then the only legal authority that was mentioned in the order actually striking the experts was the portion of Rule 30 that gives the part that says the party can depose experts. The order didn't cite to 16.1A3. It didn't cite to Rule 37B1. It didn't even cite to Rule 37A.
Wasn't discovery closed by the time the motion was filed?
It was, Your Honor.
Not the motion or the order?
I'm sorry?
Was it the motion or the order?
I believe the motion came after discovery was closed. The defendant was repeatedly trying to set these depositions and setting them, and then having Mr. Dooley, who was the counsel at that time, for one reason or another, saying, I can't do it, or not responding at all. They finally ended up taking the non-appearances, but then it was after the discovery period that the motion was.
What authority would be needed if the discovery period was already closed?
What authority would be needed for this sanction? There's several different paths that you could follow. 37B1, which it appeared.
Let's say nothing had been filed. The discovery's closed. Experts haven't been deposed. You just go on like everything's normal.
Well, from the plaintiff's side, I don't think we would ever just go on like everything was normal, because obviously it's not. But the point being, the party who seeks to exclude the experts on that basis has to cite to some authority, and the court has to follow some authority. You know, sanctions don't flow from nowhere. They flow in part from the intrinsic authority of the court, which I think is where Your Honor is going. Could the court have done that? The court probably could have done that sua sponte had it chosen to.
I mean, typically there would be the motion to compel.
Correct.
And that was the alternative motion.
And technically there has to be a motion to compel, because the failure to produce a witness for deposition is by definition a discovery dispute. And Rule 2.34 says all discovery disputes must go to the discovery commissioner. And both this court and the Supreme Court have ruled on multiple occasions that that's a mandatory provision, and that the district court doesn't have jurisdiction over a dispute like this until it has gone to the discovery commission.
So from your perspective, what happened when that motion was filed, the hearing was held, and your client and counsel weren't there?
That's exactly my perspective. Like I said, I wasn't involved in the case back then, but it appears that Mr. Dooley kept his difficulties with the case to himself rather than sharing them with his managing partner or with the local counsel, neither one of whom were aware of the problem until it reached that point. So as you saw, there's a two-page transcript of the hearing on the motion to strike, but it's also worth noting that at the hearing, the court stated that the reason for granting the motion was that it was not opposed, and which is a valid basis, but it still doesn't tell us what legal authority they're relying on for choosing that sanction.
What do we do with the fact that it wasn't opposed, that nobody appeared?
Pardon me?
How should we treat the fact that it wasn't opposed, that nobody appeared? I think respondents' contention is that it would be waived.
I think you could treat it as though it's waived, and that's certainly how the district court treated it. The problem being, the only authority for the sanction cited in the motion didn't apply, and then the court itself didn't cite to any authority. And during the discussions in the ensuing pleadings, it became clear that the court was relying on Rule 37B1, which is, and in fact, the order that denied the motion for reconsideration specifically referenced violation of the discovery order. Because 37B1, unless you get there through one of the other rules, is only for a party that violates a discovery order. 37A1 is about getting a discovery order, an order to compel. 37B1 is about what happens if you don't obey it. And that seemed to be where the court was going. The problem is the only order that was referenced was the discovery plan and scheduling order, which, although it did order the disclosure of experts, it did not order production of the experts for deposition. Now, again, I'm not minimalizing that. We should have done that. They definitely should have done that. But the fact is the rule simply doesn't apply in a situation where there's not a discovery order that's been violated. I think this whole problem stems from the fundamental procedural error of the district court in allowing this to come before the district court without first going to the discovery commissioner. If that had been...
Mr. Sharp,
yes.
Do you believe that the court has concurrent jurisdiction on discovery matters with the district court or not?
No, I don't believe... there may be exceptions.
Order?
Pardon me?
Can the court make an order to allow the court to hear discovery versus the discovery commissioner?
I believe 2.34 does provide language similar to unless otherwise ordered by the court. I unfortunately can't quote it off the top of my head, but there is exception for that, but I'm not sure whether that discretion lies with the district court. I believe it does. So, but again, that didn't happen here.
So let's back up for a moment.
Yes.
Is your position that once the experts are stricken, because this is a medical malpractice case, it acts as a terminating sanction?
Yes, and that was actually addressed in the briefing, and the Supreme Court has made very clear. We cited to an unpublished case, which unfortunately we neglected to identify as an unpublished case at the time, in which they treated the district court's imposition of a spoliation instruction as a case-ending sanction, because once that instruction was in place, the district court said there's no way the side can win, and they dismissed it. So the order itself doesn't have to be case terminating. If it inevitably results in termination of the case, then it falls under the case terminating sanctions.
So is your position that at that time, when the judge was considering the original motion to strike, the judge should have conducted the Young versus Johnny Ribeiro analysis?
I think that would have been best practices. I can't say for sure that it would have been required. But then when the motion for summary judgment came up, you know, because technically that was the case-ending sanction, not sanction, but the case dispositive order, it should have at least happened then. But the only time the district court ever even mentioned the Young factors was in the motion for reconsideration. And then all she put in her order was, I've thought about the Young factors, but she didn't do the detailed analysis that the Supreme Court has made very clear is required in the cases of case-ending sanctions. So we wound up with that order that just says, I've considered the Young factors, but we don't know what factors were considered or how they were weighed.
Is it your position that mere fact that they weren't considered means this has to be reversed?
I believe there are several bases that require it to be reversed that are independent of one another. Collectively, I think it's a clear case where it needs to be reversed. Now, what path that takes obviously would be up to this court. But yes, I believe since the district court imposed a case terminating sanction and did not ever provide detailed analysis of the Young factors, I think the Supreme Court precedent is clear that that's reversible error. They are required to make that analysis. And I don't recall the exact language, but something like detailed, particularized analysis of each of the factors. I mean, which makes sense in the context. If you're ending somebody's case, the district court should be explaining why they're doing that.
So with respect to the motion to reconsider, what should the court have considered when looking at that motion? Why should the court have reconsidered?
That's an excellent question, and covered in the motion itself, which was, for one thing, I think the court should have considered the questions that we're raising here today, like why wasn't this sent to the discovery commissioner? Why didn't the court decline to exercise jurisdiction over a discovery dispute when the district court had not expressly ordered that it would do so? That seemed to kind of fall by the wayside once the defendant chose the procedural. Oh, is that my warning? I thought I was out of time.
Go ahead and finish what you're.
I think I still have 3 minutes left. Or is that my rebuttal time? Or
that is your rebuttal time.
Oh, well, I don't want to do rebuttal yet. But I think that the court should have considered that on the motion for reconsideration. It also should have considered whether it had the discretion. One of the big things that the district court kept saying during all of this was that Judge Ballew, who, you know, had just taken the bench, and she kept bringing that fact up and saying, I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But I think my hands are tied. But the rules that we're following, especially 16b1, says the court may impose the sanction, and those sanctions may include these things, which means she had absolute discretion. And the Supreme Court's precedent says if the district court possesses discretion and declines to exercise it, that in itself is an abuse of discretion and reversible error.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Sharp.
Thank you.
You'll have 2 minutes and 10 seconds. Welcome, Ms. Erling.
Thank you.
Mr. Sharp covered a lot of points in that 12 minutes, or actually 13 minutes, that he spoke. You can pick what you think is a priority, and we'll come back to a few other points, too.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Candace Herling, and I represent the respondents in this action, Las Vegas Post Acute and Meridian Management Services. Your Honors, the rules matter. The rules of civil procedure are the backbone of our civil litigation system, and they provide a framework for fair and efficient resolution of our disputes. The scheduling order that's issued is a critical component of those rules. It sets forth the deadlines and timelines for parties to meet and ensure that the cases progress towards resolution in a timely manner. The district court provided a clear path that supported her conclusions in this case. The scheduling order, it's not a frivolous piece of paper that can be cavalierly disregarded like it was in this case. Moreover, it's not this honorable court's role to be the backbone of appellate's failures. The district court found over and over again that negligence was willful misconduct by opposing counsel and how he handled the discovery period in this case.
Ms. Erling, let me just interrupt you and ask this question. Did the scheduling order specifically require the specific identification of the experts to be made available for deposition on a specific date in accordance to the notice provisions of NRCP 30B?
Your Honor, that's a great question. The scheduling order did not specifically identify that. What the scheduling order puts forth is the deadlines that we govern ourselves by in terms of what we need to get done so that by the time the close of discovery happens, we can plan towards dispositive motion deadlines, evidentiary motion, and then trial. That scheduling order specifically said when we needed to have our initial experts disclosed and then the close of discovery. Rules 26 is the rule that provides that says that if experts are identified in a case and disclosed pursuant to 16.1, that defense or whoever is allowed to call for their deposition.
Well, that's a permissive statute. You've indicated below that it was a matter of right. Where in the statute, and I think you're quoting from 26B, there's more of it, at least Rule 26B, I think you're quoting that the depositions may be taken.
Correct.
That's permissive.
Correct.
That's not as a matter of right, correct?
It's not as a matter of right, Your Honor. However, when requested, you can't obstruct the ability of somebody to take those depositions. And Rule 26E4A is what allows you that if identified, you may call them for deposition.
And you started requesting the experts' depositions in May, and I think discovery was extended to August 2nd, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. We just started to request the expert depositions by May 26th, which was right after the rebuttal expert deadline.
And there's no question that they did disclose their experts timely, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. They did, in fact, disclose their experts timely. They did not disclose any rebuttal reports, which was what we were waiting around. Before we request their deposition, we want to make sure that we have all of the necessary opinions that are required under 16.1 before we call for that deposition or for those expert depositions.
But you waited till after the rebuttal deadline then to start getting the depositions of the experts set, and once they didn't do or prepare or disclose a rebuttal report, then you were going to set the depositions.
Correct. On that date, when the rebuttal expert deadline passed, that immediately, shortly thereafter, on May 26th, we began requesting. And we requested the depositions of the experts in this case from all the way from May 26th until July 26th. And then even in that short period of time, we also even extended the deadline by 6 weeks, the close of the initial discovery deadline, by 6 weeks to accommodate trying to get those expert depositions done.
Didn't you bring a motion to compel?
I didn't bring a motion to compel, Your Honor, because opposing counsel and I actually had a great relationship in this case. He was readily available and was calling, and we were meet and conferring. I could get a hold of him, and he would promise after promise, I'll get you availability, I'll get you availability, I'll get you availability. We have civility amongst, you know, in our, what I practice. So
2 or 3 or 4 months went by, right?
Your
At
Honor,
least
it was,
two.
It was 2 months, Your Honor. And, you know, parties are largely allowed to govern, you know, how they conduct themselves, you know, in discovery. And we don't need to run to the court and, you know, cry to the court every time we can't, you know, get a deposition right when we're requested to take it. And so we were working together all along. And it wasn't until it became absolutely known that those experts weren't going to be produced during that period. Your Honor.
Do you need to go through the discovery commissioner?
The district court can retain inherent power of discovery issues. In fact, so it doesn't have to go through the discovery commissioner. Had it been a discovery issue that the district court didn't want to take up, they often will send it to the discovery commissioner. There's no rule that specifically states that the discovery commissioner must retain jurisdiction over those issues.
Did the district court ever enter an order in this case indicating it would conduct discovery or hear the discovery matters?
It entered its scheduling order.
Right. Well, the courts have to do that now,
correct,
right?
Your
With
Honor.
The change in the rules. So other than the scheduling order, did the district court ever enter an order indicating to the parties that it would be the one handling discovery?
No, Your Honor. There was never a specific order, nor is there required to be a specific order that the district court is going to handle discovery matters. Judge Ballew, she was well within her discretion when she imposed the sanction to strike plaintiff's expert in this case. In fact, at that time that she struck the plaintiff's experts in this case, it was not a case-ending sanction, as the appellants would have you believe. At that time, there were four causes of action still in plaintiff's complaint. It was a mens mal cause of action, wrongful death, elder abuse, as well as vicarious liability for support staff at the facility. So at the time, the motion that the judge granted, the motion to strike, it was not a case-ending sanction. In fact, we didn't know what it was going to look like. It wasn't until plaintiff's counsel conceded that this was a medical malpractice case and made it into a case-ending sanction. And that is when the Young factors came into play, and the district court then on the motion for reconsideration correctly heard the Young factors and made a lengthy 11-page order after the motion for reconsideration considering the Young factors and specifically found that counsel's conduct was willful, dilatory, and
at what point did plaintiff's counsel concede that it was a med mal case? Was that after your summary judgment motion was filed?
Correct, Your Honor. It was after we filed our motion for summary judgment. So if you recall in the timeline
of
events,
you understood it to be case concluding from your perspective by filing that summary judgment.
I certainly wanted it to be case concluding. However, there were still four causes of action left in the complaint, and I filed our motion for summary judgment arguing that this was solely made up of the healthcare providers and that all causes of action would be derivative of their care and treatment. And therefore, it should be a medical malpractice case, and without experts, you grant our motion for summary judgment.
That's a very well-known rule. You can't take a medical malpractice case and call it a negligence case or elder abuse or something else unless it really is different. So you knew you were going to do that. The judge knew that's probably what the effect would be. The other side recognized it too. So, I mean, that's really parsing out a small distinction here to say, well, technically, other claims were still alive. Yes, they were, but everybody knew where they were going.
I can appreciate that. However, actually, the plaintiffs tried to pull back on that exact concession. And they pulled back on that concession when they actually eventually opposed the motion for summary judgment. That's not here before this court. However, at the time of the opposition of the when we finally got around to the arguing the MSJ and in opposition to it, they said this isn't a medical malpractice case. Actually, there are in fact causes of action that could stand. And so to categorically say that at the moment that motion to strike was granted and it was a case-ending sanction at that time, the district court wasn't aware of that. I wasn't sure whether that was going to be in fact true. And so it's...
But the district court... I'm so sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Let's back up. We missed what happened in between there. So the motion to strike the experts is filed or in the alternative to compel. Then there's an order shortening time.
Yes.
How in the world did that happen? What was the justification for it? And when you have out-of-state counsel, how are they supposed to respond in such a short time instead of having the normal time and the trial was still a ways off?
Understood. Our motion to strike was put on an order shortening time on the last day on the close of discovery. That order shortening time was served on all counsel, including the local counsel who was on every service of it. It was notification was provided, and in the motion for reconsideration, I believe in the opposition to it, opposing counsel had stated he actually did receive service of the motion on order shortening time, and they didn't pay attention to the calendaring of it, and then it wasn't calendared. So there was obvious service of the motion to strike, It was properly done. The court allowed it to be on shortening time due to the short time frame that we were on. As you may recall, though, that motion to strike, it was not only a motion to strike, but to an alternatively to compel expert testimony. And it even gave the court an option to extend yet further that discovery deadline, compel those depositions, extend the dispositive motion deadline somewhat, and then we could go about our way.
Have you ever had the experience where you rushed something and you either forgot something or you got something wrong versus if you took your time, you wouldn't have missed that?
Sure, Your Honor, except for
the most important action in the entire case gets put on a rush schedule, out-of-state counsel, maybe he knew about the original motion, did he know about the hearing? Not there. Judge essentially grants it in default. The more severe of the two requests, not to compel discovery, but to strike the experts, essentially destroying the case.
Your Honor, that service of that motion was proper. In fact, it was on not only the out-of-state counsel, but it was on local counsel, who is there to make sure that out-of-state counsel knows the rules. Also at that time, Your Honor, this was in 2021. We were remote. We were all Zoom. We were still holding remote hearings. And so you could handle this hearing from anywhere, you know, around the country. And so for there to be any kind of gamesmanship or delay that would have required opposing counsel to come here is not true. He could have attended via Zoom in that case.
Well, you still have to oppose the motion, though.
And you absolutely need to oppose the motion.
So in this case, the summary judgment was actually filed, I believe, before the motion to reconsider, perhaps, and then the court heard the motion to reconsider before hearing your summary judgment motion.
That is correct, Your Honor. And let me give you briefly on the timeline of what happened during that time. That motion to strike was granted. 2 weeks later was our dispositive, that motion was granted on September 7th, the hearing on the motion to strike was August 10th. By September 1st was the dispositive motion deadline. Defense filed the motion for summary judgment on that. In between that time frame, I had a conversation with the opposing counsel right after the hearing where he called and asked what had happened. I said, well, you lost your experts. And he did ask what he could do. I said, file a motion for reconsideration, file a motion for continuance. Heard nothing from opposing counsel. In fact, he didn't, even when our dispositive motion came down on September 1st, plaintiff did not file a motion for reconsideration for a whole nother week, requesting a reconsideration of those experts. At that time, that is when plaintiff's counsel conceded that this matter was a medical malpractice case and that that was a case-ending sanction that was done. And so the court thoughtfully and carefully then considered the Young factors when she made her finding.
Ms. Hurley, the order striking, how long was that order?
The order striking
the experts, what was it, 2 pages?
3 pages.
What was the explanation on the Young factors in that order? Can you point to anything in that order where it's mentioned?
No, Your Honor, there
was
no
any consideration of the Young factors at that hearing.
At that time, Your Honor, there was no consideration, nor did there have to be. It wasn't a case-ending sanction at that time. There was still outstanding causes of action that weren't premised in medical malpractice.
Young factors actually considered at any time in the proceedings?
The Young factors were then considered at the motion for reconsideration, and they were considered lengthy.
Can you identify them in the order where it shows that they were considered?
Yes, I can, Your Honor. If we look at the order there, the court made findings where she said, and I quote, although the court's ruling whereby plaintiff's experts were stricken does not constitute a sanction of dismissal with prejudice, in its determination herein, the court nevertheless considered the factors in Young versus Johnny. And it goes on to state that the court found that the conduct was willful, dilatory, and that the failure of a plaintiff to oppose the motion, even though diligently requested during the discovery period. Alternative or lesser sanctions were neither feasible nor fair. At that point, there was severe prejudice to the defendants, and that the scheduling order was not a frivolous paper idly entered, which can be cavalierly disregarded by counsel without peril. The plaintiff's actions and what happened were their own willful choice and willful disregard for this court's order, considering the Young factors at that hearing.
Did the court actually say any of that at the hearing?
The court did not say that any of that at the hearing, but we went through this with the court, and in the Young factors, plaintiff's counsel argued the Young factors. I argued the severe prejudice to the defendants, the willful conduct, and the dilatory, and the court found at that hearing that there was willful and dilatory conduct by plaintiff's counsel.
And who drafted that order?
The defense drafted that, Your Honor, and we passed it along to plaintiff's counsel for approval as to content.
Judge Bullard, do you have any other questions?
I do have a follow-up question. Was a Young hearing ever requested, a specific evidentiary hearing on the Young factors?
Yes, Your Honor. A Young hearing was requested, and an evidentiary hearing was held. During the time we were there to argue the hearing for the MSJ, for the motion for summary judgment, thereafter we held an evidentiary hearing at the specific request of plaintiff's counsel, where the court again found willful conduct.
But the court specifically said in relation to that evidentiary hearing that the court was not going to entertain a discussion of the Young factors. And if you look at the transcript from the motion to reconsider, it does not appear that the Young factors were in fact discussed.
In the hearing on the motion for reconsideration, while the word Young factors was not actually used, those were the things that we were deciding whether or not, and those were the things that were being argued as to whether or not the court should unwind what the striking of the expert was. And when she found that the conduct was willful and dilatory, she continued to find, even though we went through that hearing on the motion for summary judgment hearing, we talked all about the Young factors, and she again found willful conduct. Then we get to the evidentiary hearing. She finds willful conduct again there. So she gave the plaintiffs the opportunity to be heard three times on that issue and whether or and all about the Young factors and how plaintiff's counsel failed in his duties in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Herling. Mr. Sharp.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sharp, I'd like you to consider what counsel just said. Ms. Herling made a pretty good presentation that there was no trial by ambush or any untoward conduct by the respondents in this case. The respondents tried to cooperate as much as possible, and it was the former counsel for Ms. Armstrong that fell down on all this.
And as I said my first time up here, I wasn't in the case at that point, but that's certainly how it appears to me, that the fault lies entirely on the plaintiff's side. I don't have any issue with that. The problem is, as Judge Bulla was bringing up, the district court never issued an order that it was going to take on discovery or discovery disputes in this matter, and Rule 2.34 reserves jurisdiction over those to the discovery commissioner unless the district court specifically orders that it's going to handle it. Never did. It just stepped in and took that, but there was no order to that effect. The other issue with what was just discussed, you know, opposing counsel started her speech by saying rules matter. That's why I'm here, because the rules simply weren't followed. The district court did not identify the rules that she was employing and identify how the facts of this case and the procedure of this case attached to those rules. It just seemed to be, you did something really bad, I'm going to end your case, but there wasn't really any discussion in between there. Now, you brought up that the Young factors were in part discussed at the hearing on the motion for reconsideration. The problem there is the standard for reconsideration is so much higher than the standard for a motion to strike. It's got to be clearly erroneous or contrary to law before reconsideration can be granted. And we argued all along that the striking or non-striking was a discretionary call by the district judge. We didn't argue that it was wrong. I think it was wrong as a matter of law simply because she didn't identify the legal authority or spell out how she was getting to that legal authority from the facts. But to say that you can issue a dispositive sanction, and let's not kid ourselves, the motion striking the experts was a case-ending sanction. As they know, because as soon as they got that order, they filed a motion for summary judgment. And we've admitted all through the pleadings that once we lost our experts, we don't have a case. So when you're doing that and you can't impose a case-ending sanction and then months later at a hearing on a different motion say, oh, now I'm going to talk about the Young factors. The Supreme Court uses the word before the case. The court must do a detailed analysis before imposing a sanction.
Well, do you think the reconsideration hearing was in any way, shape, or form a hearing to determine the Young factors?
Absolutely not. No. We kept trying to argue that, and the court just didn't appear to think that was necessary.
Did the court indirectly do it as was just argued? Because the court did make some findings. Well, those findings aren't in terms of Young per se, but they right. touch
on. And counsel keeps saying they found that the conduct was dilatory and willful. Well, if I'm not mistaken, there are 9 factors under Young, and those are 2 of them. So, and the court never said, I want to look at these 2. Because I think you could potentially have a case where 1 or 2 of the Young factors are so egregiously present that the other factors are moot. But the court didn't say that. They didn't say, you know, I find under Young that this case dispositive sanction is justified because this was so dilatory and so egregious. It was mentioned in passing, but that hearing was not in any way a proper analysis, in addition to being far too late and applying a different standard under a motion for reconsideration. That hearing wasn't about the Young factors.
All right, thank you, Mr. Sharp, very much. We've now concluded the argument on this case. Hopefully everybody could see that it presents a very interesting issue of civil procedure in several different ways. Counsel both did a really good job. It's going to make our decision, it's already a hard enough decision, but it's going to make it better that we got this point of view. You've cleared up several points about what happened, and that's very helpful to us. It's always tough when you're not the counsel below to arguing against the counsel below. So you use that certainly to your advantage appropriately, Ms. Herling. Thank you. So we said at the outset that this would be a chance.